Associates v. Davenport, Mr. Benson.
May it please the Court, my name is John Brinson here representing Raymond Davenport. Mr. Davenport was convicted by a jury of a violation of 18 U.S.C. 2423A, transporting a minor in interstate commerce with the intent to engage in sexual conduct. He was sentenced to 8 years in prison. The primary issue at the trial was the defendant's intent when he transported the 15-year-old girl from Indiana to Kentucky. There's really no dispute that the transportation took place. The government presented the testimony of ex-agent Lanning as an expert witness. The defendant objected to his testimony for the reason that he believed it was not helpful to the jury. During the voir dire, he asked the jurors whether they felt they needed the expert testimony to explain how people have used the internet to take advantage of children. And without exception, the jurors all said they understood that. And well, they should, because it's common knowledge.
Do you question Lanning's expertise, or do you just object to the injection of his expertise into this proceeding?
I don't question his expertise. I suggest that his subject matter was not appropriate for expert testimony. His testimony has been approved by this court in Romero. However, this case is different from Romero. In Romero, there was no... The issue in Romero was his testimony in Romero was confined to the modus operandi of child molesters and how their seemingly innocent actions can, in fact, be part of a method of operation that child molesters use. In this case, he moved beyond that to talk about the compliant child theory to explain why a child might initially deny that they had been sexually molested, and he gave reasons why that might happen. They were afraid, they loved the offender, they were ashamed, and so forth. And that was particularly important in this case, because in this case, the child victim did initially say she had not been molested. She told that to the FBI agents, and she told that to her doctor. And then on a subsequent interview, she said she had been molested. This issue is, of course, important because the government has to prove intent, and whether or not the child was actually molested would certainly be relevant to intent. But the problem,
of course, is not dispositive of his intent whether he actually did it after he had the opportunity to do it, I guess, is it?
I agree with that, Ron, but it is certainly evidence that the jury could consider. And the credibility of the child witness is therefore important. So what we have here is a government-paid expert witness testifying about the credibility of a victim or a class of victims, about why she might say that she was not molested. It proceeds from the presumption of guilt. It proceeds from the theory that she was lying when she initially said she was not molested, and explains why that was said. Why that could be. I don't think it's proper expert testimony to have expert witnesses testify about the credibility of a class of victims. I objected on that basis, it was overruled, and the evidence came in. Agent Lane then moved on into that when he explained to the jury about what could happen if they did not believe the child victim. He said, Also, another important thing to understand is it is sometimes can explain or help explain why some of these offenders can have many victims over a long period of time. I've been asked this question repeatedly by a variety of individuals, including reporters, concerning how someone could be in a community and commit this crime for this long and get away with it. I objected to that. Move for a mistrial was overruled. What Agent Lanning is doing is he's not testifying even about the credibility of the witness or why she might lie. She's explaining to the jury what can happen if they find this man not guilty. That he'll go out and commit other crimes, that he's committed other crimes in the past, and that reporters, among other people, will question the jurors and ask them to explain how they could let this happen. It's clearly improper for the government to suggest that a conviction should occur to prevent future crimes. And it's clearly improper to try and intimidate the jury by saying and inferring that their verdict will be questioned by reporters. It's bound to have a chilling effect on the jury. And I think that was, in the context of the record as a whole, it was improper, clearly, and it was prejudicial in the context of the record as a whole and denied Mr. Davenport a fair trial. I objected to evidence of other bad acts, which was overruled and was admitted into evidence. The government seized a lot of adult pornography from his computer and seized a log of an internet chat he had with another individual, not the victim in this case, an individual known as PunkFairy17.
Especially the Punk Fairy 7, great name, Punk Fairy 17. Why isn't that relevant to this rescue argument? It says he's a rescuer, but at the same time he's carrying on this conversation with Punk Fairy 17, clearly is not rescue. So why isn't that relevant?
Well, I would suggest Punk Fairy 17 never suggested she needed rescuing. Punkfairy 17 never suggested that she needed rescuing, whereby the...
Yes, I know, but I mean, he has a prurient interest in these girls rather than a Good Samaritan's interest. So doesn't Punkfairy 17 interchange bear on that?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because a person can have an interest in various different people and have various different motives for interacting. He may have had a sexual interest in any number of different people, but that doesn't bear on whether or not...
It's possible. It just seems odd, right?
Yes. It is odd. The Ninth Circuit has a case, Shemin.
I mean, suppose someone killed did something bad to a black person, and he says, no, he's trying to rescue this person, actually. Something went wrong. They got hurt. And but then suppose it showed at the same time he was, making life, he was engaged in all sorts of discrimination against blacks. Now, wouldn't that there be a tension there that a jury would be entitled to consider posing on the one hand as a savior when at the same time he's acting the opposite way?
I agree with your analogy, but I...
Yeah, okay, so...
I don't think that the analogy is... I agree.
No,
it's fast, but I don't agree with the analogy. I think when a person has pornography on his computer, as the Ninth Circuit said in Shemin, that's necessary. I mean, he wants to carry on with it. He's just looking at it. It's not a necessary...
Yeah, but it shows where his sexual interests lie, right?
Well, yeah.
All his pornography were homosexual. You don't want to present that, right?
It wasn't, though, obviously.
Right?
If the pornography was homosexual?
Sure. He would want to use it as evidence that he wouldn't, that, you know, he must have been a rascal because there's no sexual interest in girls, right?
I suppose you're right. I'm here. But this court has approved evidence of other crimes dealing with culmination. I think in the Romero case and in the Long case, the court approved other evidence that the person had molested other children because his sexual intent had culminated in sexual activity. In Shumanovitz, the Ninth Circuit case, they point out that there was no culmination. And there was no culmination with Punk Fairy 17 or anyone else.
So let me ask you, I don't understand at all your argument about the guideline sentence. The judge computed the guideline sentence, gave apparently a slightly lower sentence by a month, and you argued it was a reasonably harsh sentence, so I mean, what your complaint is.
Yeah, I'm thoroughly confused about the sentencing here, and just what the facts are. I understand you were arguing for less than 5 year minimum, is that right?
I have to clear up something first. When I looked at the briefs this morning, I had argued in my brief that the base offense level was 18, or should have been, in the absence of the finding that there was actual sexual contact.
Well, that corresponds to 5 years, is that right? 18.
It would have called for a sentence below the mandatory minimum 5 years. Looking at the guideline again, I think the base offense level is 21 in the absence of any sexual contact. So I think that the base offense level, if I'm correct, was 21. And give them 4 points because their computer was involved and because he unduly influenced the child to engage in sexual activity. 25.
Well, the judge uses the base offense level.
He was 24 because the guideline says if there was sexual contact and you transported the child across state lines with intent and there was actual sexual contact, it's 24.
Is there actual sexual contact, is that an enhancement factor or is that supposed to be part of the definition of the crime?
It's an enhancement factor. It's not part of the definition of crime.
That's proper to apply that as an enhancement factor, is that?
Guidelines say you must.
Well, they make a reference to something, but I was unclear whether the thing they make a reference to refers to the definition of a crime or whether it's an enhancement.
It's complicated, I'll give you that. But I think that if you follow through the labyrinth, you come out with the proper guideline is A2A3.2, which is 24 if you transport across state lines with intent and engage in sexual contact.
Okay, so that's what he used. Now, what's your complaint?
The jury never found it.
No, you don't understand. We've said this. We've been very explicit about this. The judge has to compute the guideline sentence. That may require him to make factual findings. There's nothing wrong with that. He has to do it. After he's calculated the sentence, then he can vary from it. That's what Booker holds.
Booker and Blakely say that juvenile.
Now, look, we've made this extremely clear in our cases. The Dean case, the United States versus Dean, we have said that. The judge must compute the guideline sentence. If that requires his making fact findings, he has to make the fact finding. And then he can depart. So you have to argue, you have to argue that. And we've also said the Mikey Tia case that a sentence within the guidelines is presumptively reasonable. So you have to rebut this presumption, show that even if you gave less than guideline sentence, it's still unreasonably harsh. And you haven't made any attempt to do that.
I think that a properly computed guideline sentence is presumptively reasonable. The question is, what's properly computed mean? He got a substantially greater sentence because the court found.
Yes, you don't. I mean, listen.
You seem to think that Justice Stevens carried the day in Booker. He didn't. You're pursuing a part of Justice Stevens' opinion that was a dissent. Justice Breyer carried the day in Booker.
Obviously, Your Honors disagree with me, but...
It's not disagreement. We haven't read the case, so we don't know.
I have, Your Honor.
You haven't read Dean.
No, I haven't. I read the Kitty case.
But, yeah. Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Davis. Mr. Schoenberger, Schoenberger?
Can we follow up on the sentencing there? Because I'm not clear what the judge did exactly. Could you just tell me what he did?
Your Honor, the district court judge made findings that certain offense level enhancements applied in this case because the defendant had sexual contact with a minor. The offense itself does not require that sexual contact occur.
No, it doesn't. This reference in the guidelines might, I think, it refer to the definition of the crime, but it... But your position, and I gather your opponent's position, is that it's an enhancement, is that?
That's
correct. It reads as if that's part of the definition of crime, it seems to me, but...
In a case in which the crime of interstate transport of a minor with an intent to engage in criminal sex acts occurs, and in addition, sexual contact does occur. That calls for a four-point enhancement, offense-level enhancement under the guidelines. And the district court did find that enhancement, along with one or two other enhancements, applied in this case. It made that decision itself, independent of a jury finding or an admission on the part of the defendant, which is permissible, as the court has already pointed out.
He said it started at 18 and then he added to that. Is that right?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. The final offense level calculation that the district court made is that the defendant was at an offense level 30. It viewed that, and that would call for a sentencing range of 97 to 121 months.
Now, that was your position. That should have been the right answer, but
that was
the judge didn't agree with that, did he?
No, Your Honor. The judge then also weighed the mandatory statutory guideline factors under 3553A, and in particular, weighed in the fact that the defendant lacked any criminal record, and decided to vary very slightly from the offense level 30 and imposed an 8-year sentence, which would be a sentence at an offense level of 29 if you were to define it with relation to an offense level. And for that reason, Your Honor, it's the United States' position that the court imposed a reasonable sentence. And it certainly
wasn't listening to your expert when he gave weight to the fact that the Davenport had no criminal record.
That's correct, Your Honor. The, however, I would not agree with opposing counsel that the expert testified that this defendant must most certainly have violated annex. He was testifying in general about his findings related to cases of this sort, and that was made very clear in the record to the jury based on questions posed by me, in which he specifically stated, I'm not talking about this defendant's intention. I have not reviewed the acts or intentions of this defendant, and the jury should not conclude that I am doing so in my testimony. And so I think for that reason, the decision to overrule the motion for mistrial was appropriate in this case and was not an abuse of discretion. The district court, in its decision to permit testimony by Agent Lanning, acted consistent with precedent of this court in the Romero case, and that precedent has been likewise followed by the D.C. Circuit in the Long case and the Third Circuit in the Hayward case, all of which have specifically permitted this actual expert, the same expert, to testify on modus operandi with regard to modus operandi of persons who target children for sexual exploitation. Likewise, the evidence regarding Punk Fairy 17, the district court did not abuse its discretion in permitting that evidence, particularly when this court's opinion in Romero permitted six conversations with other purported victims that were not a part of the charge in the case to come in as 404B evidence, or and finding that that was not prejudicial. And likewise, the evidence of two other younger individuals who were not minors were permitted to testify about their experience with the defendant in the Long case, and which was decided by the D.C. Circuit. It's the government's request that this court rule that the district court did not abuse its discretion by permitting testimony from the expert on sexual exploitation, on the subject of sexual exploitation of minors, that the district court did not abuse its discretion by permitting the exhibits that were objected to that reflect a sexual interest in teenage girls on the part of Mr. Davenport, and finally to rule that that Mr. Davenport is simply wrong when he asserts that district court judges cannot make factual findings in order to determine whether certain offense level enhancements apply after Booker. That is not the law. In the McReynolds case, this court specifically stated that district court judges still make guidelines sentencing factor determinations based on a preponderance of the evidence after Booker. Unless the court has any questions, I'll conclude with my remarks.
Well, thank you, Mr. Schoenfelder. Mr. Greenstein, your time has expired, but if you have anything further, you can take a minute.
Encapsulate my argument on sentencing in a way which you may disagree, but which is basically my argument. The judge can't be required to impose a guideline sentence if it requires judicial fact-finding.
Now, you're barking up the wrong tree. The point is, he's not required to impose the guideline sentence. That's correct. But he's required to compute the guideline sentence. To compute the guideline sentence requires often fact-finding, and that's what he does. So he computes the sentence, and he decides whether to impose that sentence or a different sentence. This is extremely clear. This is not a matter of argument, actually.
Then the Kiriak case says that the guidelines, the reasonable sentence is the guideline sentence.
No, that is not what it says. That's not what it says. Look, what it says is, after the judge computes the guideline sentence, the range, if he imposes a sentence within that range, that is presumptively reasonable, but the presumption can be rebutted. So there are two steps. First, he calculates the guidelines, then he imposes the sentence. In imposing the sentence, he has to consider the sentencing factors. And then you decide whether the sentence is reasonable. Your mistake is to think that it's somehow improper for the judge in computing the guideline sentence to make his own fact findings. But he can't compute the guideline sentence without making those fact findings. So if you read the Dean case, it's all set out there.
Mr. Davenport got a substantially higher sentence based upon conduct with which he was never charged, which was never proven beyond a reasonable doubt. And what you
look, you just are missing the entire point. Look, when a jury finds a person guilty of a crime and there's a statutory minimum and maximum, he is likely to get a higher sentence based on factors which the jury did not make findings concerning, such as recidivism. You recognize that, don't you?
And there's a couple of issues in this case which I didn't even contest, such as the use of a computer and whether the child is unduly influenced. But I have a real problem with that.
Well, we have a problem, but you'll have to take it up with Congress.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Benson and Mr. Schoenberger. Next case for argument is United States.